Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. Thank you very much for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. The nuclear family is in dire straits these days, I think you will agree. It's a topic that I write and speak about often because the stability of the family is so crucial to the stability of society, to the stability of civilization. I think you will also agree that society is unraveling in various ways and for various reasons, but an absolutely central cause is that the traditional two-parent biologically related family is being and has been intentionally targeted by the radical left for deconstruction because ever since Karl Marx, the left has viewed the family unit as the primary obstacle to their goal of a collectivist utopia under the totalitarian control of the state. Marx called specifically for the abolition of the family in order to, as he put it, liberate women from the slavery of being wives and mothers so that both parents could devote their energies and loyalty to the state, while the children are raised by the collective. As any sane person can see, this abolition of the family could only lead to disastrous consequences. The damage that the left has intentionally wrought to the family over the last 50 or 60 years through the sexual revolution and abortion and gender ideology and the war on masculinity and all the rest of it, all designed to subvert and deconstruct the family, all of this has left America and Europe on the brink of demographic and cultural collapse. So how do we build families back up? How do we begin to restore what the left has taken from us and repair our broken world? Well, as luck would have it, my guest today is the author of a book called Building a Wholesome Family in a Broken World. He hails from a renowned family, a European dynasty no less, that is known for building successful, stable families and marriages, and he has drawn from that legacy to create a guideline for young people to enter into successful, stable families and marriages of their own. It says a lot, none of it good, about our culture that such a book has become essential to getting our culture back on its feet. But in any case, I've read the book, and I wish that I'd had this kind of solid advice when I was young and ridiculously naive and impulsive. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And let me say, as always, please take a moment to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already, so you can keep up with the conversations we're having here with important thinkers, writers, pundits, scholars, and storytellers. And if you like what you hear, a positive review would be greatly appreciated. Thank you. And don't touch that dial. Well, I've had a variety of mostly conservative speakers here at the intersection of politics and culture, ranging from political pundits to screenwriters to scholars, but I have never had royalty until today. Edward Habsburg, also known as Archduke Edward of Austria, is Hungary's ambassador to the Holy See or the Vatican. If the name Habsburg sounds familiar to you, it's because the Habsburg family was one of the most prominent and important dynasties in European history. They reigned in Austria, Hungary, Germany, Spain, and other places from at least as far back as the 15th century, if not before. But Archduke Edward is not only a diplomat. In addition to having written novels and screenplays, he's the author of nonfiction books on topics ranging from Thomas Aquinas to Harry Potter. Edward Habsburg, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Well, I've been very much looking forward to having this conversation. One reason is that you have a brand new book out called Building a Wholesome Family in a Broken World. And I think anyone who knows my writing and this podcast knows how important I believe family is, and that the crisis of family that we have in the West, I think, is largely responsible for this being a broken world. So I want to ask you about your book, which I have read, and I've also read your previous book, The Habsburg Way, Seven Rules for Turbulent Times, which I also want to ask you about. But first, I have to ask you about a book of yours, which I cannot find in an English translation, so I'm hoping you can steer me in the right direction, and that is your book on James Bond. I'm a bit of a Bond fanatic, and so I absolutely must have that book in English. Name your price, sir.
There was a series of books in German about 15 years ago It was called The World in 60 Minutes. The idea was a little booklet where you can read in about 60 minutes everything important about the topic that you can want to know. And the editor of that publishing house asked me which topics I would like to write about. And one of them was James Bond, and the other one was, I did Harry Potter mostly for him because Harry Potter was an incredible hype then. But my real passion was James Bond because I had very early began reading the short stories and the novels. And I also, of course, watched the movies. There was a cinema in Munich where I lived at the time that for about 1 year ran all the films one after the other in a tiny small cinema down in the basement. So I saw all of them in a very short time, and that got me hooked. Then I began reading, as I said, the novels. So I wrote a booklet that is 50% about Fleming, the books, the novels, the short stories, and 50% about the films. And I wrote it more or less when the new Casino Royale with Daniel Craig came out. And I was very skeptical while I wrote that book, but I got to like Daniel Craig quite a lot. Not every one of his Bond movies, but Craig is fine. You won't find it in English. Sean Connery is, of course, my James Bond, will always be. But I have to say that I'm surprised by how well Craig played it. My favorite Bond film is On Her Majesty's Secret Service, with Lazenby, of course.
Yeah, I'm a Sean Connery man myself, but I do like Daniel Craig very much. And I guess if I can't find an English translation of that book, I'm just going to have to learn to read German.
It's not that good. You won't find any special insight. But I got to posting the recipe for scrambled eggs 007 from one of the short stories.
About your new book, Building a Wholesome Family in a Broken World. In both this one and the previous one, you draw heavily from lessons from your family's history for guidance on creating happy, healthy, strong families today. Now, some listeners might be wondering why and how examples going back hundreds of years from a royal family would be useful or relevant to families today. Could you respond to that?
First of all, I think what I'm writing in my new book is nothing revolutionary. I write things that everybody knew for the last 2,000 years, and I suppose even for the last 10,000 years, and that suddenly got out of fashion beginning with the 60s and suddenly are not seeing relevant anymore for human beings. So it's not about the royalty that this is, but I happen to know the stories of my family because historians wrote them down. So my family, and I would say among the royal families of Europe, this is the family that you would associate with family, with having children, with having lots of children, with being Catholic and having lots of children. And the two main points of my new book is be Catholic and have lots of children. And so why not look in history for examples? Because I think the basic situation of getting married and spending a life together and growing together with someone who's very different from you and figuring out whether you have the same ideas about family and life and children and all that, that's the same situation since humans walked. And the Habsburgs, I know that when I began talking about that book on Twitter, my American friends immediately began to say, marry your cousin and inbreeding, and then posting pictures of Habsburg jaws. But I'm not advocating marrying your cousin. We don't do that anymore since a few hundred years. I'm advocating looking at some principles that might help you to get a very happy, lifelong, very fulfilled marriage. And the book is a sort of starter kit for someone who is going about that, thinking about getting engaged. Or even more, a starter kit for parents trying to give their children a principle. Principles before they even enter the dating game, because I think most people have it all backwards nowadays. And all of that is in my new book that you have mentioned. Yes,
Edward, we live in an era now that values what I call the new, the now, and the next. A lot of young people seem to think that if an idea or a value is old and traditional, it must be obsolete, and that if it's new, it must be because it's evolved and better. So I have kind of a big picture question for you. What is the value of tradition to us today? And also, how can we restore an appreciation in our culture for the grand intellectual and cultural legacy that we in the West have inherited.
Oh, Mark, don't get me started on this topic. I'll give you two very easy examples. Yesterday, my daughter came to me and we read long passages from the Iliad. This is a book written 2,600 years ago. I am able as a modern human being to understand everything that Homer wrote. I understand the emotions, the character, the drama, the beauty, everything. This is something written 2,600 years ago. Every morning I pray the Psalms in my morning prayer. The Psalms were written even 3,000 years ago. Some of them are slightly puzzling, but most of them are very understandable. What does this teach me? The fact that I can read Homer today, the fact that I can read the letters of Seneca and understand exactly what he's talking about, shows me that mankind hasn't changed. Man hasn't changed. Man is the same. Man is the same that he or she was 10,000 years ago. It's all the same. We face the same problems. And this is why tradition is so important. The old rules, the old recipes, the things that man thought about himself, herself, these things have value nowadays too. Now, we believe that's all wrong because we have the idea of history of like of science, of something cumulative getting better and better and better with every month that passes. And of course, everything that is older than 1 year must be absolutely medieval and wrong, which is so ridiculous because this is neither how science moves along nor how culture moves along. I believe we are in a terrible, terrible now plane surrounded by crumbling ruins, and we have to look for times when man was more comfortable with himself, and that's why I believe that tradition is what really carries us and can carry us into the future.
As long as we're on this topic, I'm going to skip ahead to a question I'd planned to ask you later on, but what about education? Our educational system here in America is hopelessly captured by ideologues and driven by far-left activists and teachers' unions and a fairly worthless federal Department of Education. My wife and I have homeschooled our children from day one, and you wrote in your recent book about homeschooling and a bit about education. Could you talk about that?
I am in the lucky position that I could, with my children, experience public school system and homeschooling. So I saw both of it. Several of my children were homeschooled in an American school, so I can understand the American system very much. And when I began studying children's education from the Habsburg history, and I began comparing CV studying plans that the Habsburgs used on their children in their palaces from the 16th century on, I realized this is very, very close to what nowadays parents do with homeschooling. I have a little chapter in my book called The Habsburg as Homeschoolers, and it's, of course, a little tongue-in-cheek. I'm trying to be a little provocative. And, of course, homeschooling is not possible everywhere. Also, it's very well possible that you can find a public school, or if you can afford it, a private school, that totally mirrors your values as a conservative, as a Christian, as a Catholic. And good on you if you manage to find that. I have the impression that when I went to school 30 years ago, that might even still have been, 40 years ago, that might have still been possible. But nowadays, most schools, even the ones that share your values, are extremely, extremely vulnerable for the latest hot idea, the latest fad, the latest woke mindset, plan and idea. So I say if you feel that you should go for homeschooling, I'm the last one to stop you. Of course, there are people who are critical of that. They say your child will turn out a smelly weirdo. Your child won't be able to interact with other children. But then I would point you to the other point of my book, which is have lots of children. Because if you have a large family, homeschooling is one of the most interactive and social things in the world. Homeschooling was a good experience. We also had some good experiences in public school system, but the reason we went for homeschooling were a few bad experiences in public schooling. So, yeah, I can understand both sides of the debate.
Yeah, in my personal experience, and I found this from a lot of other people that I know and that I've heard of, that homeschooling is actually great for socializing children and helping them to learn to interact, not just with, as you mentioned, children of exactly their same age as they would in a public school, but children of all ages and even adults. But I wanted to ask you or mention this. I love the opening lines of your new book. You write, quote, "What is a family? A family is the longing of every human being," unquote. And I don't know that I've ever heard it put that way. I think it gets right to the core of what family means to us. Could you elaborate on that a little?
It's just that, as I say, I am in my new book, I'm stating the obvious. I'm stating what should be the obvious. Aristotle says we are a zoon politikon, but I say we are made for family. Our way of life that we live now, where I'm sorry to say, our technocratic rulers want us alone, glued to the screen and consuming. This doesn't have anything to do with how humans grew up for the last 10,000 years. This is not what makes us happy, and this is very, very wrong. Now, why for most people family isn't the natural habitat, our natural biosphere anymore? It's because they never experienced families. Many people, unfortunately, due to the sexual revolution of the 60s and the breaking apart of families and the introduction of contraception and all of that, experience no parents at home, divorce, separated parent realities, single raising moms, single raising fathers, and no siblings. I mean, one. Look at films. Families always have two children max. If they are three, they are Irish weirdos. But you never, ever meet family as a healthy, wonderful experience. As a couple, the only way that you experience sexual pleasure is outside of wedlock, in films, always and only. You never experience a happily married couple united in that way. It's all wrong. Whatever we see around us gives us a different idea of what your life is about. But our lives are about family. That's where we get happy. That's where we will find fulfillment and happiness for all of our lives. And we'll have to reintroduce these ideas. That's why I wrote that book.
You have 6 children, 5 daughters and a son, and I have 4 daughters and a son. So it looks like you and I are doing our best to single-handedly raise the dangerously low birth rate in the West. But it does seem to me that saving a Western civilization in decline has to begin with restoring the primacy of this traditional nuclear family and with this imperative to be fruitful and multiply. If we don't do that, then in a couple of generations, there won't be anything left to save. Am I overstating that?
I absolutely agree with you. And I agree on another point. It is in the numerous family that you learn every virtue that you need to be a good citizen, to work on a better, healthier, more merciful, and more loving society. Because if you have lots of siblings, you learn the most important lesson in this world, and that's you are not the center of the universe. Yes, of course, in a way, our instinct is that we are the center of the universe. But if you have siblings, you learn that I'm not entitled to everything I want, that I have to look out for others, even if they are pesky siblings, that I have to share what I have with others, that I have to help the weaker ones in my family, that my parents cannot do everything for me, but that I have to take initiative and help organize everyday life in the family. You, growing up in a numerous family, learn all these things that are very difficult to learn if you grow up alone. You learn them by everyday life. It's not even stressful for the parents to teach you all of this because it automatically comes with number. Now, I I had 6 children. It was a great experience. It was a blessing from God. But when I traveled to the States for the first time to give one of my talks on Blessed Emperor Karl, and at the first dinner, I looked into eyes of pity because there were several families with 7, 8, or 9 children around me. While in Europe, when I speak about 6 children, people yell in panic and say whether I'm totally crazy. In the States, there was like, oh, perhaps will God send another one and something like that. There, America has a certain milieu that is open to this kind of large families, even if they're not rich, because they believe that having a large family is not only what God wants, but what's good for society and good for the two of us. So I am very hopeful that this is coming back. Right now, the numbers are small, but they are growing explosively. And most people who grew up in a family with 6 siblings will want to have a large family themselves. And that's why we have to give the world large families again, because most people never, ever even experience a large family because they never meet one. They never meet one. I'm here in Rome. Italians were the country for children par excellence over centuries. I always like to bring the example of La Strada of Fellini, a beautiful black and white neorealism movie, which is semi-documentarian. Anthony Quinn, Giulietta Masina, and they're both circus people. He's a juggler and a strongman, and she sings, and they travel through villages and make performances. And whenever you see these 1950s Italian villages, there are children to the horizon. You cannot imagine the amount of children there. And when you go now through Rome or through a village, you don't see any children. And that's not because they're all in the house in front of the computer, that too, but just because there aren't any. There aren't any. Today, I read on Twitter, I read an article saying that Poland is slowly dying. The Polish birth rates are plummeting. So this is a dramatic development. But the great thing is that you, every single one of us, can make a change. The state isn't able to tell you how many children you can have. You can make a change by your own family, by your own marriage.
Speaking of the state, Hungary's Viktor Orban is pursuing government policies to encourage large families. How is that working out there? And do you recommend that for elsewhere in the West, including America?
So first of all, it's incredibly wonderful that there is a state that does that. Hungary has been doing this since 10, 11 years. And in fact, we have had quite remarkable results. The divorce rate has gone down. The abortion rate has gone down. And the marriages have gone up. The births have gone up. But it's a very long and steep path to turn around the demographic development in your country. And it's not enough to give financial tax benefits, financial help to families. That's very important. And I myself have experienced how helpful it is to have that. But it's also important that in society, in the media, in your political leaders, there is a strong message. It's not only okay to have children, but it's something that is wonderful and great, and we appreciate it in society. Because nowadays, as a woman, if you decide to have a big family, you are branded the loser. Everybody looks at you like a weirdo. And a state that encourages people to have large families can make a huge difference. But I will honestly tell you, it's a long and hard path. And my theory is you also need faith to go with those values. Conservative values without faith will blow away when the wind is really hard. And without faith, you usually don't do the jump for more than 4 or 5 children, because if you have faith, you also are ready to jump across that greatest hurdle of all, the economic hardships, the idea, but if I have more children, then I won't be able to pay for diapers and all that. So faith is also important. And if the state cannot order you to have faith, it doesn't work.
Yes, you anticipated my question, because I was going to ask why you believe that faith is such an important component of a happy, healthy family. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, no. That's one of the reasons why I'm writing this book as a Habsburg. And if you will see that those Habsburgs over the centuries that were the most devout and with the strongest personal faith, and let their faith influence their family life, their choice of wife, and their behavior before and after marriage, those Habsburgs were the one with the happiest marriages. I have examples, several examples of, you know, in order to have a happy marriage, it really pays to live a chaste life before that. I'm a strong advocate of not going from one hot and sexy relationship to the next one and then finally settle down for marriage. That doesn't work. If you're not faithful to your wife before your marriage, you won't be faithful after you're married to her. And the best way to live a chaste and straight life, these things, is to have faith. Faith gives you the strength to go through it. Faith gives you the belief that your future marriage is in the hands of a loving God that won't leave you alone. Faith also gives you the glue to keep a marriage together, because when you get married to a woman, she is different. She has a different sex. She has a different history. She has different emotions, a different biography, different desires, different fears. Everything is different. What keeps you together is what we call love. But as my mother always says, love and emotion sometimes depend on the amount of coffee you had that day. It's a very, very wise thing she taught us as children. But if you have faith in common, and I don't mean that you were both baptized Catholic or Calvinist or whatever, but if you both of you, faith is an important element of your life, then you can face every hardship in life. And life will throw hardships at you in marriage. You and I both know that. If your first instinct of you or your wife or one of the two of you is to drag the other person into your prayer corner and says, let us pray. This is a tough moment. Let's ask God for help. This is so incredible. Even if you have a crisis between the two of you, it gives you an extra bridge between the two sexes that other people, I don't know how other people do it. So that's why I believe faith is the basis. It's the first point on my bucket list what to look for. When you look for a spouse, I put faith in first place, not hotness or something like that, but faith, because I believe if you have faith in common, nothing will throw you over.
Yes, and I think the importance of faith also holds true in the broader sense of having a happy, healthy civilization. You know, Europe, broadly speaking, used to be known as Christendom, but Christianity is in steep decline there now, and it's a similar situation here. In America, we used to consider ourselves a Christian nation, but that nowadays that is a very contentious thing to assert. The decadence of our culture, to me, seems to have coincided with Christianity having been driven from the public square. Do you think restoring the centrality of faith in our culture is crucial to a flourishing civilization? And are you optimistic that we could restore that?
As a Christian, I'm not optimistic, but hopeful. That's a fine difference. I believe that if you have families that put faith into the center of their lives, then it automatically this will return to society. You can't order it from above. It doesn't work like that. In our democracy, things come from below or should come from below. And I think the more and more families live that way and more families will put God into the center of their lives, the more faith will have a place in public space again. Right now, you're absolutely right. We're living in a time where faith neutrality seems to be a very important element of political leaders, for instance. And I very strongly disagree. I believe that it's great if you have leaders who have a faith. Because if a political leader has a faith, be that Jewish or Christian, be the different denomination than mine, I know at least to what virtues, to what ideas I can hold the other person responsible. If you are neutral, I don't know what you stand for. Therefore, I believe with more families living their faith, there'll be more political leaders living their faith, and faith will automatically return to be an integral element of society.
Your previous book, The Habsburg Way, Seven Rules for Turbulent Times, we most definitely live in turbulent times. I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but would you like to talk about a Habsburg rule or two that people today might find especially helpful?
Yes. When I was asked by the publisher to write a book about my family, I said I don't want to write a simple history book. There are hundreds, nay thousands of history books about the Habsburgs, and I want to write something different. And I thought, what are the central principles of my family? And I began writing them down. You know what makes a Habsburg tick? You could ask people on the street, not on the street anymore, unfortunately, but in general, what do you associate with the Habsburgs? And you would immediately get to Catholic faith and to family. That would be the first two things that most people would somehow know about Habsburg history. And then I went on and said, what other elements were typical for the Habsburgs? And the more I wrote, the more I realized that most of the things that made the Habsburgs strong over the centuries are things that have gone missing in our modern society. And I mean, one of the elements, for instance, I one of my chapters is called Believe in the Empire and in Subsidiarity. Subsidiarity is an incredibly important word for our time. I believe it's the ultimate antidote to globalism. It's the ultimate human way of looking at things. Subsidiarity is what Catholic social teaching teaches, and it is something that is trying to be swept under the carpet, for instance, in the European Union here in Europe. And so that's one of the things I discovered. Then, you know, one of the reasons I think why many Americans have lost their confidence in their political leaders is because political leaders, even kings, except in the few cases where it went wrong, were guarantors of law and of justice. There was a kind of agreement between the king and his people that he would guarantee law and justice. And we are seeing political leaders that seem to be sometimes interested in other things, sometimes not listening to their people anymore, listening to other people, or perhaps only in politics for a short while and then find a plum job somewhere in a nice financial sector or business or so. So our people are seeing political leaders that don't sacrifice their life for their people. And I believe the Habsburgs over centuries, in many examples, really tried to do that. And so what I'm seeing is many elements that were the positive sides of my family that I want to propose for the 21st century. And that's why I wrote that first book.
Let me back up for just a moment and ask you if you could explain a little bit about subsidiarity, because I've read the book and I know that chapter, but could you explain a little bit about what that is for the listeners and how subsidiarity works?
Subsidiarity is a principle that the United States are built upon. The Holy Roman Empire was built upon, and the Habsburg Empire was built upon. And therefore, it's an important expression. I would say the easiest definition is subsidiarity is the principle that the lower level should look after things. Say that people that live in the village know better about the problems in the village than the people in the capital. And people in the capital know better about the country than people in the capital of the state know better about the state than people in the federal capital. And you should leave things on the lower level. Children should learn to put order into their own shoes and clothes and not let the parents do that all the time. Subsidiarity is that. And when subsidiarity goes wrong, you have centralism. For instance, whenever a Habsburg ruler like Joseph II tried to ignore the cultural richness of the different nations in his empire, and the different languages, the different legal systems, the different courts, and the different parliaments, but decided we just need one language for everybody, and we centralize everything and govern everything from Vienna. That's when the Habsburg Empire went really, really wrong. And this is, if you look at the United States today, the United States are and still are United States. Most people forget that this means something. You could tell it over the last years in a few moments of crisis when single states decided to go differently than the federal level because the states still have that power. So you see, subsidiarity is baked into the American DNA, and a principle that is very important. Human beings are fiercely local. We believe that the family, the township, perhaps the state, are the highest level that is still normal for humans. Everything above that is already very far away. And we're living in a time where we have the feeling that these levels don't count, that all the big decisions are being taken on the global level. And that is very alien to the way humans are built. And that's why I believe subsidiarity is very important.
I found it interesting that you have chapters about death in both of your most recent books. What's the importance of embracing a good death and of being with your family, if possible, as you pass on?
We live in very turbulent times. You repeated that just before. And I believe that most things are up for grabs. You believe, most people believe nowadays that they can define and change everything they are, they will be, they believe in their bodies, their mindset. Everything can be changed every few weeks. But there is one thing that is absolutely secure, one of the very few things in this universe that are secure. You are going to die. That's a very, very, and over the centuries, death, of course, has been the greatest terror to people, because you knew your life is finite and our mind revolts against the fact that we're going to die. And on the other hand, many philosophers, and of course the Christian faith, have drawn lots of strength from the fact that we were going to die and that our life is not all, because we feel in us that death is unnatural. And it is unnatural, because in the original plan of God, we didn't have to die. Death came with sin. So what I believe is, it's a great message to know that this life is a very tiny part of your existence. You are made for eternity. You're never going to die. But this life here is the arena in which you prepare for that other life. And your death is the moment you have to prepare all your life for. The Habsburgs, over the centuries, prepared for their death. All of them prepared for their death because they knew that they had great responsibility, as, you know, Spider-Man, Uncle Ben, with great responsibility. With great powers came great responsibility. The Habsburgs knew that God would ask them one day, how did you use the power that I gave you over your people? So they prepared for death. They wanted to have a death with the sacraments, in unity with God, so they could give back what they had received in peace. And in my first book, I write many examples of how Habsburgs died, how they prepared their funerals. And there is a deep meaning in the Habsburg funerals, a message also for their peoples. In the new book, I write about what the most beautiful way of dying is, ideally surrounded by your family. And I encourage people to try to be around their loved ones when they die, try to pray with them, sing with them, and let the children experience a death in a family. Ideally, it's difficult nowadays, of course. We have pushed death to the absolute edge of our perception, something that only happens in hospitals far away behind doors. But for millennia, it used to be part of family life. That's why I'm speaking about that so much.
Well, I think that's great advice to keep the end in mind. In fact, both of these books are just loaded with great advice. I wish that I'd had both when I was young and insanely naive. They would have helped me avoid a long, painful stretch of aimlessness and of not knowing myself. So I highly recommend both these books. Edward, where can people go online to keep up with your thoughts and what you are doing?
I am very active on Twitter, which they now call X, but it will always be Twitter to me. I, for the time being, am slowly creeping to 100,000 followers. That's a rather normal number of followers, which enables me to actually interact with people also who reach out to me. I regularly have direct messages. I always try to answer. I try to answer to people who answer to my tweets. And that's a place where you can meet me every day. I try to spread an atmosphere of cheer, of wholesomeness, friendliness, of some monster movies and a bit of family, a bit of faith and a bit of Hungary around myself. And I think it's a nice place. I believe in building these little wholesome corners in the internet where you encounter civilization as it should be. Yeah, civilization, you will also find me talking about Roman classical stuff, statues and historians from the antique times. So yeah, you can meet me there and see you there if you want to follow me. I will in many cases be able to write back.
Excellent. Good to know. Well, Ambassador Edward Habsburg, thank you so much for coming to the Right Take podcast. I think you're doing great work in terms of promoting faith and family.
And thank you very much for the kind things you said about my books. I hope many other people will find a few nuggets of wisdom there.
Oh, they will. Listeners, pick up a copy of The Habsburg Way, Seven Rules for Turbulent Times, and also his latest book, Building a Wholesome Family in a Broken World. Get those for yourselves, or at the very least, for any young, naive loved ones, young and naive like I used to be, people who need guidance in these turbulent times and in this broken world. And thank you, as always, for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so that you can keep up with all the important conversations we're having here. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.